In this episode of the New York Baseball Podcast, we break down the season that was for the 2018 New York Yankees alongside Sweeney Murney. Wally, we got a big guest.
Yeah, he was on with us a couple of weeks ago, and I can't think of a guy who is better to break down the Yankee season with because he was at just about every single game.
Yeah, he pretty much saw every single pitch. He'll break down the Red Sox series and maybe a look forward to the offseason with the Didi news and what's going to go on with a lot of free agency. A lot to talk about. Let's get into it right now. All right, Wally, we're back. It's been a little bit of a hiatus for us. Is it going to be a hiatus for the New York Yankees and the New York Mets until spring training next year, come February?
Well, I doubt that. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of activity, especially around the Yankees. Mets got to find a GM.
There's a lot going on between both teams. This Yankee offseason really got flipped upside down 35 minutes into that press conference when it was Jason Zillow, the PR.
He goes, yeah, this might be a good time to let the guys know that we've lost our shortstop probably for all of next year.
He's like, oh, by the way, he's been very, like, Didi Gregorius is going to miss the
Now, I understand, let me just, somebody pointed out to me, and I didn't, at first, my first reaction was, you know, what the hell? I mean, this is the news. The reason why Jason Zillow did it that way, okay, was because he didn't want the press conference to become only about Didi. He wanted to get the other issues out of the way. And I understand that, but it wound up adding another half hour to Aaron Boone's press conference. And then, you know, of course, the Cashman press conference was nothing but Didi, and what are you going to do about it?
It really just turned everything upside down because that's a huge injury, and it really, like, sets off a domino effect on this offseason. This offseason we thought was going to be for the Yankees, you know, adding starting pitching and tinkering with a lineup that is, you know, somewhat complete if you take a look around the infield positions and you know, adding starting pitching, like I just said. But, you know, throwing this Didi injury now you're hearing, like,
everything.
Machado, you're hearing move Gleyber to short. The Yankees will go out and get a left-handed hitting second baseman. Or do you, you know, keep Gleyber at second and then you go and find a shortstop that can replace Didi? Or, you know, if this injury, you know, this has happened before. You've seen guys come back in 6 months. You've seen guys come back in 8 months. You've seen guys miss the entire season.
Well, so maybe we don't see Didi again. Pitchers miss a year.
Yeah.
Now, you know, a shortstop who's not going to make that many throws, you know, obviously it's not going to be relied upon to throw 100 pitches, might need less time. Gleyber needed 8 months, and it was his non-throwing arm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would use that as a yardstick, which means, you know, Didi hasn't even had the surgery yet, but he'll have it this month. So let's count. November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June. You're putting him right around the All-Star.
That's 9 months. That's, like, right in the middle. I think some guy on Twitter had an actual, like, a chart of all the non-pitchers that have gotten Tommy John surgery in the last couple of years. So Rafael Furcal, remember that name?
Sure do.
He missed 15 months. He had major setbacks. Look at TJ Rivera on the Mets. He had Tommy John surgery.
Right.
And he
missed the whole season.
And he missed the whole entire season. So you never know, especially with Didi, the fact that he's a free agent at the end of next season.
That's a bad break for him. You know, I've kind of come to like Didi. He can be difficult at times, but, I mean, his walk year is next year. He's going to miss all but, you know, a couple of months of it at best.
And he was a guy that you know, there were rumblings about giving him an extension. The Yankees don't exactly do that, especially before you hit your free agency. I think Brett Gardner was one of the only other Yankees that got extended.
And that was a huge surprise.
And right, and that was that four-year, $52 million deal at the time where we were like, wow, that's a crazy amount of money for Brett Gardner, but it turned out to be a very good deal for the Yankees, and I could see that happening with Didi.
It's insurance for Ellsbury.
Look at Cashman. I mean, in Cashman we trust as Yankee fans. But you were at that press conference, and, you know, let's talk a little bit about this Red Sox series. I feel like it's been a week since the Yankees were eliminated. There's just everything you can you've heard every which way about why they lost. But when it comes down to it, Wally, we're just talking off the air. Again, the Yankees just didn't get that big hit, and their starting pitchers just didn't live up to it.
Yeah, I think that the series was really lost in game one when they didn't get the performance they thought they were going to get out of J-Hap. You know, I really think they were counting on at least one, if not two, wins out of him, because that's why they got him. I mean, they traded him for precisely that reason. He's a very good pitcher. But the thing that really set him apart from the other guys who were out there was the fact that he's good against the Red Sox.
And they put up that first inning home run to J.D. Martinez really set the tone for the series. It wasn't even a good pitch to hit. It was like an inside tailing fastball that J.D. Martinez just, you know, took those hands in.
Well, J.D. Martinez had, you know, like an MVP caliber season.
Right.
And, you know, we can do a whole show on, you know, looking back on why Stanton and why not Martinez. You know, did the Yankees make a mistake signing Stanton?
Well, anyone could have had J.D. Martinez.
Absolutely, and I think they did make a huge mistake signing Stanton, even without J.D. Martinez, because I didn't think he was necessary, and I've written a couple of columns about it. But the truth of the matter is, you can't really blame Happ. He didn't pitch all that badly. But the Yankees were counting on him to win at least, you know, one game, and the first game would have been the game to win. Well,
even in that first game, it wasn't just Happ. It was the fact that they had so many chances to get the lead, and they got it to 5-4. Judge hits that home run in the ninth. You know, you feel like you had Kimbrel on the ropes the entire series, but they just couldn't get that big hit. 4-for-26 runners in scoring position in the series. And Tyler Kepner of New York Times wrote a pretty good article, pretty much the difference between the Yankees and the Red Sox. It was very close between the two teams. It's just that the Red Sox executed a little more. And he had a great excerpt from this story he wrote. Since the AL adopted the designated hitter in 1973, the Yankees have hit for a lower batting average than .249 just three times. In 1990, when they lost 95 games, 2013, 2014, when they missed the playoffs, and 2018, they hit .249
like
on
that.
The nose.
Well, because they're an all-or-nothing team. I don't think there's been any doubt about that. And you know, Tyler always writes a great column and finds, you know, the perfect little nugget that shows you, you know, what went wrong there. That's been the problem all year. And I'll tell you what, again, you know, I don't want to make Stanton like the punching bag here, but the worst at-bat of the entire series was in the ninth inning of Game 4. I mean, you've got Kimbrel, he can't even throw a strike.
He bailed him out big
time. Two guys are on. There's nobody out. This guy cannot throw a goddamn strike. And Giancarlo Stanton swings and misses at three pitches out of the strike zone.
Not only that, did you see the first pitch slider? His knees, he almost jumped. His feet almost came off the ground. Like, he was getting full. He had no plan up there. It's unfortunate.
No, he had a good season. His plan was to hit the ball out of the park.
Right. Nothing else. But another excerpt here. Last season, the Yankees had two more hits than the Red Sox. That's last season. This season, Red Sox had 135 more hits than the Yankees.
Well, you know, that's why it's always so meaningless and why I had to laugh. And sometimes it actually frustrated me when people talked about, well, look at how many home runs they're hitting. Yeah, all right, great. How many they out-hit the Red Sox for home runs? By what, 20-some-odd home runs?
Right.
Okay. Who finished ahead in the division?
That's why the Red Sox are still playing
Thank you.
Because they found ways to win without hitting the home run. That 16-1 game, they hit one home run.
Right.
One home run out of that, and it was Brock Holt off of Andrew Romine.
Right.
When he hit for the cycle.
Right, off Austin Romine. Yeah, that's right.
That's right. What I meant, Austin Romine.
Unfortunately, right. I was really rooting for Austin Romine to strike somebody out because
he actually was throwing 91. It wasn't bad.
I don't know if that radar got
me. They were cheesing it up?
A lot of lollipops were coming in, man. And I'll tell you, he pitched a bit in high school, but there's no bigger humiliation to a major league player than to get struck out by a position guy.
But going back to Stanton, and I hear a lot of comparisons to A-Rod because he's the high-paid import. He's the highest-paid player in baseball, or he is until Machado and Bryce Harper sign on the dotted line. But you can't compare Stanton to A-Rod anymore.
Not at
I think
all,
it's
no.
an insult to A-Rod.
It absolutely is.
Who was
is.
A student that of the game, who could break down his swing almost on the
hitter.
Point. Right. You're absolutely right. And I'm hearing a lot of that, and I just think it's kind of a disservice to A-Rod.
Yeah, but I see what the parallel is, you know, a failure in the postseason. And A-Rod had a lot of them until 2009. I mean, let's not forget, Joe Torre batted them eighth in 2007. You know, there's no bigger smack in the face than that, especially to a player as good as A-Rod. So, yeah, the parallel is in his first postseason, he failed. He may have a great postseason next year. We may forget all about this, and people might look back and say, boy, you jerks who jumped on Giancarlo Stanton back in 2018. And that's perfectly fair. I understand that. But we can only go by what we see now. And what we've seen now, you know, is not favorable.
He had a brutal, brutal postseason. I mean, just terrible at bats. And you're right. You don't know. You go out there and you sign the best player or you trade for the best player. And Cashman said that in his press conference. He was very you know, he didn't throw Stanton under the bus. He pretty much said, listen, we acquired one of the top hitting players in baseball. You know, you can't predict what happens in October. You just have to hope that, you know, next October he performs.
Right. And, you know, there's an old saying that you don't turn down a Hall of Fame player and you don't trade one away. Whether Stanton's a Hall of Fame player eventually, I don't know. I mean, if he keeps doing what he's doing for another 10 years, he is. There's no doubt about that. But I just kind of feel like Cashman was seduced by the numbers. I really do. You know, he's like he was the bright, shiny object that they went after without really thinking about
it.
And they got him at somewhat of a discount. You know,
compared to what Harper and Machado are going to get. Yeah, right. He is a discount.
So, you know, I understand the temptation there, but I just don't think that I don't know. Listen, I'm not an analytics guy on the level of Cashman's guys, and you know he's got these geniuses.
Oh, jeez, that's a whole conversation,
you
know, we can
have. So they I'm sure they looked at every possible angle. I just wonder if they really did an analysis of where this guy's going to fit into the lineup and what he's going to bring.
Well, analytics came into focus this season with the Yankees more so than ever. I feel like with Boone in there and a whole new regime with Cashman and his underlings, you know. Kind of bringing it down there, and now you're seeing this analytics versus scouting debate, but it really isn't a debate because you can say like scouting and analytics are two different things. The scouting, you think of an old guy at, you know, in the stands with a radar gun as a scout, using his eyes.
Who watches the
games. Using his eyes and you know, having a feel for what makes a great ball player versus analytics. But from everything I hear, and while you probably know this better than I do, the Yankees are hiring scouts now that are analytical scouts. Which is a whole new thing now. So it doesn't really, there is no analytics versus scouting anymore in front offices.
They're trying to merge the two. But exactly. You know what? Let's go back to Boone for a second.
All right.
You know, obviously you can make the case that he stayed with both his pitchers too long, Severino and CC. And you just wonder, you know, he talked about in the press conference, this kind of got forgotten because of the Didi news.
Right.
But, you know, and he was asked a very good question. I think it was Lindsay Adler, the Athletic.
She's great.
And she said, you know, how do you communicate all the information you have to the players? And he said that that's a problem. And when I heard his answer was very convoluted, and I can call it up. I have the transcript somewhere on my computer here. But his answer was convoluted, and the bottom line of it was that there's a lot of information and they're not sure how to get it to the players. And I'm wondering if he's buried in a blizzard of information.
Too much stuff.
And that's why you're not making the decisions you have to make.
It's baseball. Just, you don't have to, you know what I mean? It's so much too
much. Right. You're sitting on the bench. You're watching your pitcher melt down. And you're worried about, you know, what your data says. The hell with that. What do your eyes say?
Yeah, it's crazy. That's another thing I wanted to ask you. Can analytics work in a short series? I don't think so.
No, because I think it'll only predict long-term results.
It works in a regular season. You can't deny that analytics do not work during a 162-game season.
No, because it works because you need a long...
Right.
Thinking about a baseball season, it is a marathon, you know, and over time, guys are going to be consistent for the most part. You look at a guy's, you know, the old back of the baseball card thing. Before analytics, guys were saying that. Look on the back of the baseball card and I'll tell you what I'm going to do.
Right.
Because players are consistent. Now, do you need, you know, all those detailed stats to tell you what guys knew years ago? That players are consistent. A 250 hitter is probably going to be a 250 hitter next year and the year after and the year after. Guy that hits 30 home runs is going to hit 30 home runs until he starts to fall off.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I don't know if it's predictive for a short series. You're probably right. It's predictive over the course of 162 games.
That's what Boone has to work on this offseason. That's what he's going to be thinking about this offseason. It is, you know, he had his first foray into the postseason. I would say that he came away with a D.
I don't think he did well in in-game management,
no.
Quite honestly.
But if you look at the other side, you know, Alex Cora managed circles around him because, yes, the Red Sox employ analytics, but not as far as the Yankees do. Everything I've heard is that Dombrowski has an analytical team, but he lets his manager coach. And you can see that in the differences between the two teams because, you know, Cora made some ballsy moves. Like he made, you know, pushed Eovaldi up, bringing Porcello in the eighth inning, bringing Sale in the eighth inning, switching around matchups that normally wouldn't
happen.
Yeah,
but now he's getting criticized for not using Kimbrel in game one.
Right. Everything gets, you know, it's
so, I mean,
one game.
Perfect.
Exactly. You're only as good as your last game. But what I'm trying to say is that Cora, I feel like, is the perfect combination of analytics of new school and going with your gut. And I feel like that Boone has to kind of evolve into that. And we'll see if the Yankees allow it, first of all.
Well, see, that's the other thing. You know, I heard you say that, you know, they're allowing Cora to manage. I don't know if anybody is not allowing Aaron Boone to manage, quite honestly. I mean, you know, it's an easy thing to say, well, you know, Cashman's telling him everything to do. We don't know if that's true. We do know that he is getting a ton of information, probably more than Girardi got, definitely more than Joe Torre got. Whether that's hampering his ability to react doesn't mean the Yankees are telling him, you know, don't do this, don't do that. He may just be paralyzed by all the information.
Too much information. It's a great point. And another thing before we get to Sweeney Murdy is that the Alex Cora, yes, a rookie manager, but where was he last October? He was on the bench coach for the Houston Astros. Who is Alex Cora's bench coach right now with the Red Sox? Ron Renicki, who managed in Major League Baseball, is a veteran who's been around the game. Yankees bench coach is Josh Bard, who's right. Pretty much, you know, come on, Before that, you even any Yankee fan even know who Josh Bird was?
No, but the truth is, right, the point is that you have inexperienced guys running the Yankees.
Right. Well, why not bring in, you know, a bench coach that you know, has been there, you know, and they're not making any changes. I didn't expect them to make any changes with their managerial staff. But, you know, look at the Red Sox. Look across the way. Look at your division rival. They have the analytics. They have the scouting. They have a manager who will make some gutsy moves. And they were the better team, and they're still playing.
One thing I'll say, though, I think Aaron Boone a smart guy, and I realize, you know, they said there won't be any coaching changes, meaning nobody's getting fired.
Right.
Doesn't mean he won't think about it and say, hey, you know what, let's add somebody, or maybe we move Josh to something else, you know, maybe he becomes a first base coach, maybe I use him as this or that, you know, who knows, it may happen. He may think about it and say, hey, I really could use an experienced guy next to me on the bench.
It's all setting up for you-know-who to be the bench coach of the New York Yankees.
Don't say Girardi.
Alex Rodriguez.
No way.
Did you see him in the Red Sox jersey?
No, but I did see him yesterday.
I saw that you tweeted
the photo. What was with the sunglasses?
You don't understand. Like, he tweets and he puts out the weirdest photos of himself.
But why the sunglasses?
With like a caption.
Indoors.
It would be like a picture of A-Rod in like a three-piece suit, and he'll be like, thoughts on game three? Like, the three-piece suit does not match the caption.
Oh, God.
He's
man,
just a funny guy.
He just can't help himself. But there's an old saying that if you wear sunglasses indoors, you're either blind or an asshole. He's got very good eyes.
I'm going to just leave it at that, yeah. But him in the Red Sox in jersey, the bet that he lost with Ortiz over this series, loser had to wear the Ortiz had to wear a Yankee jersey, A-Rod would have to wear a Red Sox jersey, and then they had to get sprayed in champagne on air. Great TV. Great TV. Listen, those guys have done everything at this point. You know, there's a lot of things on TV you've already seen a billion times.
Actually, I haven't seen them. I don't watch those things.
When it comes to postseason, you know, post-game shows. But A-Rod coming out of that room with the Red Sox jersey on was wild.
And he was drenched in champagne?
Ortiz sprayed him
down.
Sprayed him.
Oh, yeah. Boy. God, messed
put
up his hair
on,
everything.
And then he ripped open his shirt and he had a Yankee shirt on. He goes, I'm a Yankee
Lord.
Forever. Some like choreographed line. It was good. It was good to you. I enjoyed it.
Please send me a link. I must see this.
You got it. It's good stuff. But let's get to Sweeney Murdy. We're going to get even deeper into the postseason. We'll get even deeper into what went wrong in this Red Sox series. A guy that has spent many, many years with the New York Yankees, especially the 2018 season. Here he is, Sweeney Murdy. All right, before we get to Sweeney Murdy, Wally, I'm sure you noticed baseball season winding down, but football season is in full swing. College football, basketball starting. So I got to tell you about MyBookie.net. MyBookie.net is the industry-leading sports action website that offers real Vegas odds on football, baseball, and all your favorite sporting events. You can take a side, the total. You can even bet on the over-under on how many fantasy points a player will score. MyBookie.net lets you play online and win big. You want to use promo code NEWYORK100 when you register for your account, and you will get a 100% sign-up bonus. Are you worried that the game already kicked off? Don't sweat it. MyBookie.net has in-game live action on every major league event, even esports. There's no better time than to join MyBookie.net than today. Go to MyBookie.net to open an account and start winning. Once again, you want to use promo code NEWYORK100 when you register. You get yourself a 100% signing bonus. Get in on the action right now by going to MyBookie.net. Website today, and you're going to use promo code NEWYORK100. Get that 100% sign-up bonus. Once again, mybookie.net, promo code NEWYORK100 for the 100% bonus. No deposit necessary. Terms and conditions apply. For entertainment purposes only, void where prohibited.
Well, Dan, you know, there's no more appropriate guest to have at the end of a baseball season, especially Yankee season, than our next guest. The guy was at just about every single game, in the clubhouse every single day, at the post-game interviews, on top of everything, tweets like the best stats ever. I've stolen more of his tweets than probably anybody's. If we keep those kind of numbers, I'm sure somebody is somewhere.
Someone's up there keeping track of
that. You know it, but the Yankee reporter for WFAN, the one and only Sweeney Murdy, joins us on the NYNY Baseball Pod, my good friend as well. Sweeney, thanks so much for joining us on this wrap-up show. As we decompress from the season, I don't know about you, but I find it like a little strange having been around the team like every day for 6 to 9 months to suddenly like have it just go away. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it just kind of ends, you know. It's I like I like the beginning of a season. I like the end of a season. You know, it's, I guess it's kind of like a school year.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to the beginning. I always look forward to the end. You know, it's just, there's very few things where you can just kind of put, you know, kind of put in, into a, you know, you just put in a book, I guess is the best way to put it. It's, every season has its own story, and it's not like going to work the same place in a 9-to-5 job.
You
just, you have a beginning and an end to everything. And then you look forward to the next one, which kind of begins almost right away. But yeah, it is strange not having to get out, and go to the park. It's strange watching the games on TV. Hmm. It's strange, you know, being in bed, you know, before 2 a.m., which doesn't happen.
Yeah, right.
You
know, it's hard to get back to a normal life.
It's crazy.
It really is.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't mind it. You know, you get used to it again very quickly.
I know, and then it's hard to get out of it once spring training starts.
Yeah, I mean, I think, listen, you know, we've done this long enough where I think you get to a point where you're glad it's over, and then you get to a point where you want it to start again.
You're absolutely right. You know, I was thinking about this when I was driving in today. Like, what are the moments from this season that I'll take away? Like, what are my best memories of it? You know, what are the things that really stuck in my mind? And I got to tell you, the two moments that really stuck in my mind this year were two moments where the Yankees just missed. And I'll tell you what they were. The Greg Bird fly out in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded the day Josh Bard ran the team. And Gary Sanchez just missing the home run that would have won the game last week. I mean, to me, those are the two things that stick in my mind more than any game-winning hit. And I don't know, you know, I know you're by nature more positive than I am, so maybe your memories are different. but when you think
like
back
to just misses, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, like, to me, those were the big stories. Like, wow, you know, that is more compelling than, you know, a 16-to-1 game or something like that. But as I said, you're a more by nature positive person than me. What will you take out of 2018?
Oh, that's a really good question. Nobody's asked me that yet. I haven't really thought of it in those terms. I guess, you know, it's like, for me, it was getting to get to know a whole new group of people, a whole new manager and coaching staff, and see how they operate and kind of build that again. It was different because this was, you know, I had covered Aaron Boone as a player. So this is the first time the manager was younger than me.
That'll get worse and worse, by the way, as you go along.
I think as you look at as a season, though, I guess I had seen this season building to a Yankees Red Sox showdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since, you know, like June, like everybody else, and the end result, not because they lost, but it didn't feel very fulfilling because the series itself wasn't, you know, it wasn't 2003. It wasn't 2004.
Right.
I've said for a long time, people ask me, what are your favorite memories of covering the Yankees? I just finished my 18th season. And as far as individual games, I point to game sevens in 2003 and 2004 because of how vastly different they ended and how dramatically they ended and everything that was at stake and the energy of those two games. Nothing that we saw in this playoff series matched the energy of that. And maybe it's just building to that, but I just didn't, you know, I kept anticipating this great finish between the Yankees and Red Sox, you know, really September and October, the way they were going to play six times in the final 2 weeks and then meet again in the playoffs a couple of days later. I felt there was possibility for this amazing conclusion, and that conclusion never really came.
Well, what about, I mean, the bottom of the ninth inning at Yankee Stadium, game four, was pretty exciting. I mean, you know, you were on the edge of your seat, didn't really know how the game was going to end. Right. I mean, it was a nightmare for me, having to write on deadline because I don't know what I'm writing. I don't know if they're coming back to win this game or, you know, they're just going to fizzle out.
Yeah.
And it turns out they fizzled out. But when you know, you come within a run and you have your tying runs on base, you know, it's exciting. But, yes, it did end in a rather, you know.
It ended
on a replay challenge.
That is just perfect.
If he had actually hit that home run, then we'd be, you know, we'd be going on to a game five and paralleling things that happened in 03 and 04.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. So right. I can't quite, I just can't quite put it in that same category yet.
But, you know, before we get into specifics.
Like I said, it has nothing to do with the fact that they lost.
Right.
It's just that the climactic part of it wasn't the same.
No, I understand that. You know, before we get into any specifics about, you know, what the Yankees might do straight ahead and, you know, and what they're going to, how they're going to deal with the Didi situation and all. The thing about Aaron Boone was, and, you know, I understand, you know, we did meet a whole new cast of characters this year, but I felt like he made the transition kind of easy. I kind of, after a few games, I kind of felt like he was here for a long time. I don't know if you got the same kind of feeling. I mean, we have been around Girardi for 10 years, but I didn't feel like it was a really jarring transition. I mean, obviously Aaron Boone's a different guy, but he just made it easy to work with him, I thought.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I think we kept waiting for that moment where it was going to show that he was new and this was too much. And listen, no, maybe
we may have seen
making
that.
The pitching changes in game three and game four was it. But over the course of a season, just game to game and pregame interactions, postgame interactions, there was nothing about this that was foreign to him. There was nothing that he couldn't handle. Listen, there are veteran managers that make the same types of mistakes or similar mistakes. Joe Girardi didn't issue a replay challenge when it was clear that he should have, and it almost cost him that series. Aaron Boone should have taken out Luis Severino before he did. And he's not the first manager to go through something like that. So I don't think it's necessarily, oh, he's never done this before, he's in over his head. He made a poor decision. And
but these things do get magnified when you're a new manager. Obviously, they get magnified.
Absolutely.
Now, Sweeney, you know, talking about Aaron Boone, and I feel like a lot of the criticism after the series was lumped on his desk, so to say. But you know, just going back, how shocked were you by some of his decisions, most notably with the starting pitching, with Severino in Game Three, and then leaving CeCe in a little too long in Game Four?
Yeah, Severino is the one that puzzled me. CeCe did to a different degree. I understood what his reasoning was. Severino was just pretty clear. Like, he even said himself, he only wanted to get him through three more batters. Well, then you knew it was time to take him out.
Right.
If Luis Severino is not the guy you know he's not good enough to keep going and go deep into this game, then you've got to know that, you know, trying to squeeze three more outs out of him is probably not the best thing. Yeah, that's really the one that I thought was the more egregious of the two. I understood what he was getting at with Sabathia, and Sabathia is a different kind of pitcher. He's not the overpowering kind of guy. Listen, the other part of that, and Brian Cashman alluded to this after the season, the Yankees did nothing against Nathan Eovaldi or Rick Porcello to the point where, you know, a pitching change might not have made it would have changed how the Red Sox had to deploy their bullpen, because they wouldn't have had as big a lead, and that might have changed things a little bit. But you know, the pitching changes got focus. The fact that the hitters didn't hit probably, you know, was more of a factor why they lost.
See, I kind of disagree respectfully, of course, but I think that Sabathia, leaving him in and his explanation for why he left him in Game 4, you know, we just want to get to the end of the lineup. You know, we didn't want to burn out our bullpen. We had it set up for later in the game. In an elimination game, how you're not managing, like, it's, you know, pitch by pitch, out by out, especially when the season's hanging in the balance. As a fan, you know, I took a little more exception to him leaving in CeCe than I did with Severino, because I felt like that game was getting away from him no matter what, Game 3.
I could see that. And, like, the biggest thing to me is that the Yankees knew all year their strength is their back-end relievers, or one of their strengths. And you don't leave your best players sitting when, you know, when you're in the most crucial spots. And that's, you know, the Yankees were setting up their pitching so they could run these guys out there. So I do get what you're saying, because in game, you know, before game four, Boone said that he could get potentially 6 to 8 innings out of some of his relievers.
Right.
So I just think that the signs were not as strong to remove Sabathia at that point as they were with Severino. That's probably a better way to put it.
You know, Sweeney, you raised a great point a couple of sentences back about getting your best players into the game. How does he not get Miguel Andujar to the plate in Game 4?
Well, I think that, that's another one where I was really surprised how it didn't happen, because I was all on board and really kind of, you could see it happening with starting Neil Walker.
Oh, it made perfect sense. That made perfect sense.
But once he's out of the game, then it no longer is serving the purpose that you originally intended, and you're behind in the game. I really thought Andujar was going to make the appearance. And now the platoon advantage didn't work for you because Porcello was still in the game.
Right.
And, I get all that. But at some point, even if it was just one swing, it needed to find a place for him to get off the bench in place of Walker.
It was the ninth inning.
That was –
Well, the ninth inning, you would have had to send him up for Voit or for Stanton.
Also against Kimbrel. You weren't going to get you weren't going to find the lefty in that ball game because they knew Andujar was staying on the bench. So, the Red Sox won that little maneuver, and, you never found the spot to get him.
Yeah.
I don't think that was his intention, was to leave him on the bench the whole game. I was just surprised that there wasn't a spot at some point to.
There probably was a spot earlier in the game.
Even without the platoon advantage, I think you still needed to roll the dice there and get him in the game.
The one thing, and I want to move on from that series because it's over now, but the business about, taking the pitchers out or leaving them in too long kind of points to a complaint that fans had with Boone throughout the year, that there was a lack of urgency with him in some sense, and that I think part of it is his personality. I think he's pretty laid back. I don't think he gets all that excited. We did see him lose his temper a couple of times, but I think that the fans perceived that there was a lack of urgency throughout the season with him about anything. And then when you see him leave starting pitchers in too long, not reacting the way, fans of course always want to, they want instantaneous reactions. They want results right away. But I think it kind of reinforced that perception to them that there's a lack of urgency to this guy.
I think the thing that everybody has to remember when they're watching these games that, you can't have every reliever always ready to go the minute a guy gets in trouble. Sometimes a guy has to be able to get himself out of trouble, and sometimes the trouble happens too quick to warm guys up. You can't just bring a guy in because the pitcher's in trouble. You've got to be able to get guys ready, and you can't always have guys up and getting ready, because then the guy maybe blows through the inning, and you've wasted the guy getting warmed up.
No.
It's a fine line sometimes. It really is.
It definitely is.
You're going to be caught on the wrong side of it.
But you know what? There was a point in Game 3 especially when it was obvious that Severino was in trouble and nobody was in the bullpen.
I totally agree with that.
And people in the press box, it was like, Dan and I...
He started the fourth inning.
Yeah, right.
He just should not have started the inning. That was really... And once he had him in to start the inning, he was committed to trying to get him through these guys. And it was just kind of compounding on the fact that he started the inning.
But he kind of boxed himself into a corner because he had nobody ready to come in. It kind of reminded me, people in the press box saying, why doesn't he have anybody up? It reminded me of like sitting at ringside sometimes in a one-sided fight and you're thinking, why isn't the referee stopping the fight?
Stop it now, man.
Why is he waiting so long? And I got the
different.
Same feeling.
He has the ability to stop it instantaneously. You don't have the ability to bring the pitcher in instantaneously.
Absolutely.
Now, Sweeney, just going back, before we go into the offseason and the Didi news and what can transpire in these next couple months, we brought up Miguel Andujar, and I feel like a lot of fans want to know, how do they move forward with this guy? Getting subbed out of games in the sixth inning, I feel like was kind of unprecedented. Not playing in that game 4 with the season on the line. What's the Yankees feeling with him moving forward at third base? Or do you feel like a position change is going to come with this guy? There's so much in flux now with Didi going down. Where do you see Miguel Andujar next opening day? Where will he be?
Well, I don't think, pulling a guy out for defense or sitting one of your best players is unprecedented. sometimes there are lineup decisions we have to make.
Right. I remember the sixth inning. Taking him out in the sixth, Torrey, I felt like was crazy.
Joe Torre had to sit players because of a DH rule in the World Series. You know, he had to sit Tino Martinez, mm-hmm. who drove in 100-something runs, 30-something home runs. And he had Cecil Fielder play first base instead. These are things that you have to do sometimes. This was a different kind of situation, but again, you had a matchup that you needed a different player physically playing third base. I think the mistake we all make sometimes is that because a player isn't good at a certain thing, we assume he's never going to ever be good at it ever again, or never has the ability to improve. I don't think the Yankees feel that he is beyond repair. They made a decision in a crucial part of the season that they needed better value defensively at that spot in that game. That doesn't mean that they have no belief in Miguel Andujar, that they have somehow shattered his confidence. They let him play an entire season at third base as a rookie, and he deserved it. Mm-hmm. But he also showed where he needs to improve. And that's all the Yankees' goal is to figure out how to get this guy better at that position.
And Boone made it seem as if it was a matter of footwork and something that they can work on. I mean, there's also a school of thought that maybe at some point this guy's a first baseman. I don't think he has a lot of range. He's got a decent arm.
I've heard left, too.
I feel like it's offensive to first baseman to just say these things.
Right. Dude, that's where you put the fat kid in the softball team.
Like it's not an important position, and that his athleticism and his range and everything else don't come into play.
Of course.
His throws are bad because he has bad form. Well, don't you want to see the 3-6-3 double play turned out once
Absolutely.
In a while, too?
Hey, listen.
I don't think it's that easy to just say throw him over at first base.
No, I'll give you two words.
Does,
Alex Rodriguez.
Him over at that spot and watch what he does. You know, if you watch him in batting practice, he makes every throw perfectly in batting practice. When he gets into the game, he starts sidearm swinging it and his footwork mm-hmm. gets awry. It's not that he can't do it. It's just trying to get him to get it to be less, more muscle memory and just do it as opposed to thinking about it. You know, they're working with him on this constantly, every single day. At some point, the player has to get it.
Right.
No, without a doubt. Sweeney, I don't mean to say that first base is easy to play. I mean, you know, Alex Rodriguez, one of the best natural baseball players either one of us has ever seen, couldn't do it, didn't want to do it. Even, you know, in my limited experience of playing first base in the media game, I'm always shocked by how much you have to remember.
It's all footwork,
you know,
too.
Yeah, it's all like, footwork. You know, where to stand. If the runner is here, you go here. If the pitcher is – you know, there's a lot to it. Mike Piazza, Hall of Famer, couldn't do it. So I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying a guy without a lot of left-to-right range might be, you know, more suited to a corner infield position than, you know, obviously he's never going to be a second baseman or a shortstop.
Yeah, and I just don't think it's time to pull the plug on that yet at third base, especially if you've got other first base options happening. I think it's fluid. I wouldn't, you know, shut the door on it, but if you have to move pieces around and that's where he ends up, okay. But I don't think that simply because the Yankees decided to defense for him in the sixth inning of a playoff game or didn't play him in a playoff game because of defense is the reason to not ever let him play the position again.
And I had friends who brought up, you know, Derek Jeter was a poor defender. I was like, yeah, that was when he was 18. He made 56 errors in rookie ball.
And that's also according to, you know, defensive metrics, which are very, very shaky at best.
Yeah, and let's remember, you know, there was a poll of Baseball America poll mm-hmm. of the minor league managers in that league the year that at Greensboro when he made 56 errors.
Right.
He was voted the best defensive shortstop in the league. The year he made 56 errors, he was voted the best defensive
because,
shortstop.
Because, you know, listen, you and I watched him for 20 years. Anything hit at that guy was an out. There was no,
correct.
You never saw a bad throw. You didn't see, you know, him blow a grounder. You never saw, you know, anything go off his glove. He didn't have a lot of range. But, I mean, if you hit it to him, that was it. You know, the inning was over. That was, you know, the third out was made. And that's, you know, that's something that the defensive metrics don't really cover.
But the reason I bring up Jeter.
The reason
I bring up Jeter is because, you know, just to this point that a friend of mine made was that he was 18. He had still had room to develop. You know, Andujar is still young. What is he, 23 years old? Do you feel like he still has time to become an average defender? I don't think he'll ever be an above average defender at third.
He has all the ability to do that. I mean, and you're right. We haven't seen him play a whole lot yet. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't think anything you've seen is a reason to say he's never going to be, he never should be allowed to play that position again. Mm-hmm. That's the mistake we make. We live in a world where everybody wants extremes. You're either great or you're terrible.
Right.
I think that there's a lot in between there.
Yeah. I agree with that too. Sweeney, let's talk about a guy who's already proven that he can play his position. You know, we're sitting in the press conference and we're talking about, you know, the Red Sox and the pitching decisions and blah, blah, blah. And a half hour have gone by and then suddenly they drop a bomb on us that Didi Gregorius needs Tommy John surgery and is going to miss a chunk of time. I mean, whether it's 6 months, 8 months, or a year, it's a lot. How do you think this affects what the Yankees do this offseason?
Well, I think they have to. I think the mistake they don't want to make, again, is assuming he's going to be there for a large part of the season and not have the plan for that. Very recently, you had the Aaron Judge situation.
Yep.
3 weeks turned into 7 weeks. And listen, that's just – sometimes that's not anybody's fault. That's a person trying to heal and not on plan.
Right. I mean, even Greg Bird last year, you know, they were planning on him being there out of spring training. And, you know, how much time did he miss?
The more relevant example for me here is Derek Jeter after he broke his ankle in 2012.
Right.
He had surgery in October and was supposed to be back in 4 to 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't play his first game for the Yankees until July the following year, went back on the DL two more times and played a total of 13 games.
Yep.
The Yankees had Eduardo Nunez and Brendan Ryan playing more games. Reed Brignac played more games at shortstop that season for the Yankees.
I forgot he was even on the team.
Those are those lean years where they won 85 games.
Things got so bad at that position that the Yankees called a player who had been released named Luis Cruz. I almost forgot his name.
Yes.
Luis Cruz
On
vacation with his family in Disneyland when the Yankees called him up and said, hey, do you want to play shortstop for the New York Yankees?
Hold on, let me ask my wife.
That is where the Yankees were at that position at that point in time. They need a firm, this is who we want to be our shortstop for 6 months. If Didi Gregorius comes back, great, we'll adjust. But we have to know that this guy can play shortstop for us all season long at a level we're comfortable with, because this is not an 84 or 85 win team. This is a 100 win team looking to be a championship team.
A 100 win team that was considered that's considered a failure by a lot of its fan base. So yeah, they're expected to improve next year. Now let me ask you this: do you think, you know, I wrote a column last week for the Daily News saying this now opens the door. They got to go after Machado because they need, you know, and I realize, you know, he's a third baseman now, but he could, you know, things can change.
Have you seen some of the throws he's been making? And this guy can play short.
Yeah, I know that. I know exactly what this guy can do. Do you think they need to make that kind of a move, or can they get by with guys like Echevarria, with moving Gleyber over, or maybe picking up some other guy? You know, do you stopgap this thing, or do you go after the best guy you can get?
Echevarria to me is the Brendan Ryan, Reed Brignac Band-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Gleyber Torres is interesting to me because if I'm looking at the other holes I have to fill and the other costs I have to lay out, because you need starting pitching, you have to pay for that. You could very easily see Jay Happ and Patrick Corbin being Yankees next season, right?
Yep.
You've got a layout for that. I still am never going to believe that Bryce Harper won't be a Yankee until I see him holding up some other jersey and cap in a press conference.
Wow. Why do you think so?
If all of these are part of your possible plan to spend, Gleyber Torres at shortstop at major league minimum is a really good option.
And do you bring back Neil Walker?
Second base somehow, then I think that you could do that. It gives you the kind of fallback of if and when Didi comes back. And if you're looking long-term, you know, Didi could cost a whole lot less than Manny Machado. Remember, because he's a free agent after next season.
Yes.
So I'm not certain that, you know, I think they're going to be involved in this somehow, but I'm not sure that that's how it ends up. The Yankees are involved in everybody. They're going to have their hands in on every free agent. Are they going to be playing in El Machado? Of course they will. Is he going to end up being a Yankee? I can't answer that, but I feel like having Torres available to them is something that is a little bit of a luxury that not every team that loses a starting shortstop the caliber of Didi Gregorius has.
That's true, but if you, but now reading right to left, this is your possible Yankee infield for next year, if that's the way they go. Luke Voit, who's pretty unproven, you know, he's given us a couple of very good months. Maybe Neil Walker at second, Glaber back at shortstop, and Miguel Andujar, who, you know, is being pulled out, as Dan pointed out, as for a defensive replacement in the most important games of the year. Is that the kind of an infield that would make you particularly confident?
No, but I'm not saying that Luke Voit's going to be the, you know, primary first baseman next year either, you know? I don't know that, that's, you know, he still has a lot to prove too.
Yeah.
I think many teams have made a mistake of handing a guy a starting job over the course of, 5 good weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Yankees have fallen into that boat before. I think a lot of teams have.
Sure.
And I don't think, you know, listen, can Bryce Harper play first base? Maybe.
He did take ground balls. He did take ground balls.
They do have a lot of outfielders right now. That's why I wanted to go back to that. What makes you so sure that they, especially since, look, the Yankees can say whatever they want publicly about Stanton. They can't be happy with his performance in the postseason at least, and he was extremely inconsistent throughout the season. Are they going to take the plunge for another player who's pretty similar at the plate to Giancarlo Stanton and Bryce Harper? Do you think they will do that again?
I don't believe they're similar, but I think that this is a marriage that has been kind of waiting to happen for a long time. If you go back and look at the when Bryce Harper was a Sports Illustrated cover boy,
mm-hmm.
high school kid, you know, he talks about dreaming of playing for the Yankees and going to the Hall of Fame and being in Monument Park. The Yankees have kept an eye on him for a long time, you know. He's now a free agent. He is younger than Aaron Judge. Remember mm-hmm. that.
That's wild.
So you're talking about getting younger and more
athletic.
Yeah. Well,
this is the rare free agent.
Luke Voit doesn't fit that profile.
No, not at all. And it is, he's a rare free agent like Machado, whose best days are actually
Correct.
Ahead of him. You know, most
Correct.
Free agents have already done what they're going to do.
I feel like there have been a lot of things that have, you know, there has been nothing along the way to tell me that he doesn't want to play here and that they don't want him. And now that it's finally possible to happen, I can't believe that it's not going to until I see it not happen.
So if for that outfield, though, it would be if you make room for Harper, would you put Stanton in left and then have Harper play right? You put Harper at first, and you can then put Gardner and Frazier, whoever plays left.
Gardner. You're just assuming that Brett Gardner is
coming back. It's a big assumption.
A huge assumption.
Big assumption.
You're
but
assuming he's coming back as a starting player also.
Him and Frazier or some type of left fielder, or if they bring back McCutcheon.
I can't count on Clint Frazier right now because I don't know who he is.
Right.
You know, he spent an entire year with concussion issues.
Yep.
I don't know who he is. I can't, you know, how many at-bats did he get last year? I can't just stick him into my outfield.
No.
So where would you put Harper?
I would put Harper either at first base or in left field, depending on what other people I have coming into this.
Interesting.
You know, Gardner could very well be a part of this.
Yeah, but I think he's a bench player. I think you're right.
Platoon, bench.
I agree that that's probably a more suitable role at this point. If don't pick up the option, bring him back at a lesser salary. You know, I'm going to make you laugh. You know, Jacoby Ellsbury is going to come to spring training.
That
you know?
Name just went through my mind, and what I was thinking of. Not only is he going to be at spring training, but he's going to promise to have a bounce back year.
Yeah.
He can promise whatever he wants, but I know he's going to say that.
Yeah, let's just see what happens. But yeah. Listen, they've got enough bodies that where you kind of move things around. But I don't think finding a place for Bryce Harper to play is the problem. It's
right.
Finding a place for these other guys to play. It's a problem.
Going back to the Andujar, I'm not the Andujar, the Glaber conversation about moving him to short. How do you, there's a school of thought maybe about moving him around this early in his career. Like, I feel like he was just getting used to playing second. He had those lapses in I would say concentration where he made a few errors that weren't exactly skill level there. But where would you say about moving him to short, moving around so early in his career when he's just trying to learn second base, and you saw a little bit of a decline in his hitting at some point after the All-Star break? Do you think moving him around could potentially harm him early on in his career?
I'm not asking him to be catcher. I'm not asking him to be center fielder. I'm asking him to play the position that he has played every year up mm-hmm. until this year.
Right.
Position he was drafted at.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think it's a reach. I agree that sometimes the lapses in concentration are a problem. He's 21, okay? Hopefully that'll get better. Again, we're going back to an issue where we think that this something that is a problem is never going to get better or doesn't have the ability to get better. I think that's the mistake.
And I think Gleyber certainly, you know, has more potential to be an outstanding infielder than Andujar, who I think has potential to be a good infielder. Fine, acceptable infielder. But I think he was acceptable for most of the season, quite honestly.
I think we saw him make some plays that tell you he can be an excellent defender. It's just about, you know, making sure you're in it all the time. That's all.
Now, an important question, and I actually asked Brian Cashman this question at the press conference last week. How much do you think Hal's obsession, or at least his desire to stay under the salary cap threshold, which they did this year, will impact what they do this winter? Or will the fact that they've reset the clock here allow them to maybe spend a little bit more than the $206 million threshold?
Brian's answer to that question was telling in a way, in that, you know, the Yankees are forced to, by going over the threshold and paying their penalties, they're forced to subsidize the teams they're in competition with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you know, McDonald's doesn't pay Burger King so they can buy hamburgers.
They don't send free cows over there, do they? No.
They the Yankees can't put other teams out of business. They need these, you know, this is the cooperation.
It is a collective to some extent.
I think that what they're doing is resetting the tax value does two things to me. It lessens the amount of money they are paying to their teams, and it lessens the impact out of their own pockets so that they can go out and get these free agents. I don't think they did this simply to get under it to stay under it. I think they got under it to reset the tax
value. Right, because
that was what it was.
Yes. Yeah. For our listeners who don't understand how it works.
I think they have the ability to go under it, and I think I don't it would not shock me if they did go over.
They've blown past it. But here's the implication of it for our listeners who don't understand it. The threshold next year will be $206 million. For every dollar they go over it, they will have to contribute 20% into the pool. So, therefore,
as opposed to 50%, which
if you go over three times in a row, right?
Yeah, which would used to mean when you think of a player who costs $30 million a year, he would cost you $45 million.
Right, exactly.
And that is no longer the penalty.
Right, but another way to look at it is if the Yankees decide to blow past it, and let's say they go to $220 million, okay? They would be $14 million over the threshold and would then kick in 20% of $14 million, which is $2.8 million. Would that be worth it to add Machado and Bryce Harper to your roster? It might be.
It might be, yeah. You know, you've got to think of a lot of things. I feel the other part about Harper, to me, you know, the Yankees are very right-handed, and you know, if you look, history lesson for you, okay? The Yankees win World Series with left-handed power and left-handed pitching.
Mm-hmm.
They don't win the World Series without enough of either one, and right now they don't have enough of either one.
So outside of Harper. I know that's like kind of we don't know if that's going to happen or not. Where can they fit in a lefty bat in this lineup?
Well, if Greg Bird can reclaim first base.
Yeah, that's one.
And he's going to get a chance.
Part of it.
He'll definitely get a chance.
That's not outside of the realm of possibility.
He showed you a whole lot this year. I think, you know, the switch hitting power mm-hmm. had been missing for a long time too. And I think Hicks showed you a lot of that. So, I don't know who's playing second base.
Well, if it's Walker, you got to switch hitter there too.
There's a school of thought where Walker has a full spring training and he showed some promise during the second half, and even in, you know, he had some clutch at bats
in there. I think, you know, I think you have to wait to see. Based off the year that he had, he might not receive a lot of big offers, and maybe this is a place he wants to come back to. We will see, you know, where that plays out too.
Daniel Murphy is a name that's being thrown around. I know a lot of New Yorkers know that name, but
I'm glad you mentioned him.
He's not a good defender, but you know he can hit in October, that's for sure.
Well, he hit in an October, okay?
It got Carlos Beltran a pretty big contract.
Well, and listen, just because Stanton didn't hit this October doesn't mean he's not going to hit in another.
Absolutely. We said that in our open, too. You just don't know. The Yankees went out and got one of the better premier hitters, and you just have to hope that they perform in October.
Listen, Barry Bonds was awful in his postseasons with Pittsburgh early in his career. If he was a free agent every year in the 1990s, you're telling me that you wouldn't want him as a player because he didn't hit in October? You know, you can't predict for October. You can't build a team for October. You build a team to get you through 162 games and try to finish in first place, which, by the way, the Yankees haven't done since 2012. It boggled my mind when I had to think about that because we've covered playoff games. The Yankees haven't won a division title since 2012.
It's crazy.
So their goal is to be first. First things first, finish first.
And
that's how you build a team. If you happen to be good enough at the end to kind of maneuver things a little bit and get through a series, great. But you can't sit here and try to predict who's going to play well in October, and that's how you build your team.
Cashman said something during the press conference that really stuck out to me, and it kind of goes to the point that you just made. He said something like, our goal is to be the best team in baseball. Our goal is to win a World Series. He goes, we weren't the best team in the AL this year. We weren't even the best team in the division. And he kind of said it, and he's, you know how he can be when he says stuff so matter-of-factly. It was like a cold statement right there that the Yankees still have a lot of work to do. And I saw that you tweeted something, too, after the season had ended and a few days went past, and you said, you know, the Yankees just, you know, they just aren't at championship level yet. They're still building.
I think we tend to forget because they went to Game 7 last year, they added Stanton, and we say, well, the Yankees are the Yankees. They're a World Series team, which they definitely were a contender. There's no doubt about it. But the last 2 years, who did they lose to? They lost to the Astros and the Red Sox. Both teams were significantly better than them in the regular season and then beat them in series. Now, even if you have a better record, you can lose in a short series, but the overall point is that they were not better than them over the course of every aspect of the season.
Right.
I think that's where we have to sit back and remember, as much as we expect the Yankees to be the Yankees and who they are, this was not a one-year rebuild. We're still moving in that rebuild phase. I mean, they're a good team. They just haven't been a championship level team.
You know what part of the problem is? They overachieved last year.
Right.
And once do that, once you overachieve, now you've put yourself on the level of all these other teams.
Yep.
Now you're expected to do that every year. You know, I don't want to hear you rebuilding. You came within a win of the World Series. Now, you know, I expect you to get that win.
They won nine more games
a year ago.
Right. Problem is, there were two other teams that still finished better than me.
Exactly.
What was the window? Remember, for years, it was like the Yankees were good in 2016, finishing that year. The Yankees are going to be even better in 2017. And then it was like, what was that window where they were expected to compete? What was it, 2019, 2020? They said this is when the Yankees championship level.
But they arrived faster than that. And now you have to play to that level.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, listen, nobody's going to cry for them because they put high expectations on themselves by playing too well. That's just the reality of what happens. But to me, it's just this idea that we tend to forget that other teams have the ability to be good.
Yep.
And oh my gosh, sometimes they might be.
And you want to know something? And the financial landscape is much more even now than it used to be. You know, it's not. It's no longer. You know, even if the Yankees want Bryce Harper, they may very well get outbid. I mean, you know, there are other teams with money now.
It's not just financial. You know, everything about analytics is getting information to find the best players at, you know, that may be undervalued, and that's how it started. Now, you know, you're looking. Everybody has a lot of the same information, and you're no longer able to just throw money at somebody and say, okay, now you're better than they are. And by the way, you had some luck too. I think the biggest mistake we or anybody else looking at the Yankees makes is expecting them to win three World Series in a row, because that's what the Yankees do.
Right.
The Yankees' history is built on little mini dynasties everywhere, right?
Yep.
You know, 2009 is an outlier. That's the only championship in Yankees history that doesn't have another one in close proximity. Mm-hmm. The Yankees win championships in bunches. In 2009, they won one. You could kind of lump it in with the others because the core four were part of it. But
right.
in reality, it had been 9 years since they won, and it'll be at least nine since they win again. So I think that the new reality of this is that, you know, we want the Yankees to be the Yankees. Well, maybe the new Yankees are just a team that can and will contend and might win a World Series. But if you think that they have to win four out of five for this to be some sort of stamp of success, you're going to be
crazy.
Waiting an awfully long time.
Yeah, well, I've been saying this for a long time, Sweeney, that, you know, that there's a generation of Yankee fans who were, say, 12 years old in 1996 and believe that, you know, this is the way it goes, you know. Well, we win four in a row, and then
yeah,
we have a
me.
Couple of down years. That's not, the reality in most of, in 29 other major league cities is that when you get to the World Series, you're thrilled and you hope to get back there again sometime in your lifetime.
Right.
It doesn't happen
Correct.
The way it happened here. But it makes for an interesting offseason. And Sweeney, as always, your insights on this are excellent. What do you plan to do? Got anything good planned for your winter now?
I'm trying to get myself back in shape.
Okay.
I've got different things happening with the kiddos that I will be here for.
Terrific.
I'm kind of trying to clean up my office right now as we speak.
Nice.
And get into a little working condition. I've got some Netflix things to catch up on. I've
Netflix.
Got some guitar lessons I want to take.
That's why I was waiting for that. You're going to get back into your guitar.
I am, as soon as I finish with you, I'm going to go eat lunch.
Okay.
And I'm going to go look up some YouTube things and mess around on the guitar for a little bit because it's time to pick up my kitchen.
Okay. I'll give you a couple of hints. Marty Schwartz, pretty good. Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm.
He's a guitar teacher on YouTube. There's another guy a little more advanced. He calls himself Papa Stash, Stache. He's pretty good. There's these guys that call themselves the Beatle Men who will teach you to play every single Beatles song.
Yeah.
They're very, very
sounds
good.
Sounds like you've been taking guitar lessons.
I've been playing for like 10 years.
Really?
Now. Yeah, man.
So I'm going to see Sweeney and Wally.
Well, listen, text me some of the beginner stuff. Because
I
I'm
will.
Still the beginner stage.
I will, man, because there's some things that you'll knock out in a day, I'm telling you, and then you and I are going to jam together.
Sweeney, I know another good good teacher for you, Bernie Williams. I heard he plays the guitar.
Yes. No, I've been telling him this for – and actually, you know what? As long as we're here, you mentioned this, I'm going to throw out a little plug. I've been mentioning this to Bernie for years that I wanted him to give me a guitar lesson and turn that into a podcast.
Mm.
And that instead of talking baseball, we're just going to play, he's going to teach me guitar.
That would be great.
But the plug portion of this is on November 10th in New Rochelle, Bernie Williams is hosting his annual charity benefit in which he does play with his band for it benefits the Hillside Food Outreach, which is a organization in Westchester, Putnam counties, and Fairfield counties in Connecticut that feeds hungry families.
Mm-hmm.
It's a local church-based group, very small, kind of mom-and-pop charity that Bernie just befriended and lent his hand to now for, I think, 15 years maybe or something like that. I've helped Bernie out with it for Bernie's, I think, maybe done it for 20 years. I've helped Bernie out with this for about maybe 10 years or so. And he does phenomenal work just trying to raise some money. It's November 10th. It's in New Rochelle. If you go to hillsidefoodoutreach.org, hillsidefoodoutreach.org, you'll find the ability to get tickets there. Come watch Bernie play. There's some auction items. It's baseball related, some not baseball related. We have a guest, featured guest that I do a Q&A with, me, Bernie, and then whoever the guests are. Jim Morris, the guy who Dennis Quaid played in The Rookie.
Mm-hmm.
Is going to share his inspirational story with
wow.
us, and hopefully a few other surprises along
Sounds
the way.
Sounds great. That's awesome.
So, yeah, that's something that I look forward to every winter as well.
I'm coming. I'm going to come and write a column for the Daily News about it. That sounds great. Thanks.
Excellent.
You just gave me a day's work. Terrific.
There you go.
Right. Sweeney, thanks so much for joining us for twice this season, and thanks so much for being the final guest of the 2018 NYNY Baseball Pod. Great having you on, man.
Thank you, Sweeney.
All right, fellas. Thanks for having me.
All right.
We'll talk soon.
Yes, sir. Take care.
There he is.
All right. All right. So now I know where I'm going to be November 10th.
November 10th.
I'm bringing my guitar, too.
After I say happy birthday to Nick on November 10th, I'll head over to...
Oh, is that your birthday? Terrific.
I'll head over to the New Rochelle.
Our very fine producer, Nick Canobio.
Yeah, speaking of, you know, the season wrapping up, Nick did a great job this season as our engineer, as our cameraman, as our...
Having to listen to this.
Just staring at us while we talk. Bob Canobio, of course, doing everything that he does. It's a full team over here.
What does he do exactly back there?
He's everything, man. He's pumping out. He writes the checks. He's pumping out. He's sending out his CompuBox stats. I'm getting emails about, you know, different stat packages.
I thought he just ate pizza back there. That too.
That too. But Sweeney was awesome. That's the perfect guest to kind of break down a season and kind of give you the full scope. You know, yeah, you the know broad what? Strokes as
Sweeney
about, can do.
Not only that, he watches the games very, very closely. He analyzes the games deeply, and I think he's extremely objective, even though he's around the Yankees a lot. I mean, he sees what's wrong with the team. He sees what's right with the team. You know, he doesn't fall into hysteria. He doesn't fall into fan speak. He watches the games as a professional, and he's able to communicate it, which is why he's done it for so long.
How about Bryce Harper and Pinstripes?
I'm not completely sold on that. I think that's kind of
what is
like,
he talking about? He doesn't know anything he's talking about, Sweeney.
No, he does. And he's right. The Yankees have targeted this guy for a long time, but true. I think that the landscape was different then. And I think that Stanton kind of changed that dynamic a little bit. But we'll see. I mean, anything's possible. We've seen the Yankees, you know, back up the truck and just load up everybody they can get. Who knows? Would you be shocked if they wound up getting both Bryce Harper and Machado?
I'd be shocked, both of them.
And a top-line pitcher? Who knows?
I'd be shocked. But they've also, you know, you say they coveted Harper, but they've really coveted Machado. I mean, they tried to trade for him. They didn't try to trade for Harper last year.
And the other thing is the resetting of the luxury tax threshold is huge.
Yeah.
You know, paying 20% as opposed to 50%, because if you go 3 years in a row, now you got to pay 50% of every dollar you go over. And the threshold is up to $206 million. That's a lot.
Yeah, it's
right
moved
there.
Up from 197 for
the last
5 years.
Yeah, so they can blow past that, you know, by $20, $30 million and not have to pay all that much by their standards.
I'm sure you saw this, that the Yes Network is currently going to be back up for partial sale. Now, the Yankees sold a majority stake in it to, I think it was Fox News.
To Fox, yeah. Now, Disney.
To Fox.
Disney then bought Fox Entertainment, right, so, and they're spinning off all of the Fox properties.
Right now, the Yankees currently own 20% of Yes. So that's why you turn on Yes after a big game. You can hear a little more, more criticism, a little more. They're open.
I'm not sure I would draw that straight line, because what you're implying is that the Yankees would censor their guys, and maybe they will.
I feel like they did.
Maybe they will, but we've had John Flaherty on, we've had David Cone on.
Yeah, but they're not
going
to say it.
Well, they've always said that and not only that, who was more critical? And I understand what you're saying, that, you know, the Yankees no longer are the controlling voice there. But there was nobody more critical of Severino warming up late than Flaherty. He was more critical than Ron Darling.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They're more critical now because they don't own a majority of the network. I feel like years back, you know, during the Jeter years, when Yes first got around, it was almost like they were, I'm not going to say shills, but it was almost like they were just the mouthpiece.
You're forgetting something. Who was involved back then?
I think his name is George Steinbrenner.
Yeah, he's dead.
He is deceased.
And I don't think Hal Steinbrenner is quite that invested in what announcers say. I mean, Randy Levine might be, but I'll have to see it before I draw that line.
But more importantly than, you know, criticism on Yes and how they handle their postgame and all that, this sale could have implications with the payroll. You know, if they add more money in, if they have a more majority stake of the Yes Network, that means more money flowing in. Not that the Yankees have any money issues, but...
It's also a huge investment.
It is.
Talking about $4 billion.
Yeah, so, but I'm just trying to put two and two together here. Yeah. Could them purchasing the Yes Network, getting that money back, getting more of a cash flow in there, could that open up the checkbooks a little more?
No, I don't think so,
because
I don't think cash flow is the problem. I think the problem is, and Sweeney alluded to it, and I thought he was going to read the quote, and I'll just paraphrase it. But, you know, Brian Cashman did say, you know, we don't want to be, you know, subsidizing other teams. I think that's a philosophy there. It has nothing to do with how much they're spending. They don't like the idea.
No, I think every fan can agree with that.
That's what it is. They don't like the idea of giving corporate welfare to baseball teams, which are all making money.
Right.
You know, and I think I would say, however, if the commissioner had the gumption and the teeth and the balls to say to those other teams, any money you take out of luxury tax has to go back into the payroll.
Team. Right. Because look at the Rays. They make money. Everyone makes money. Every baseball team makes money.
There's never been a team sold for less than it
exactly.
was paid for.
And a lot of these teams don't put the money back into the team. They put it, you know, give it to their investors or they just sit on it. And the Yankees have always done the opposite. They've always invested.
Actually,
back
let
to
me
the
amend
team.
What I just said. There's only been one baseball team in history
that
sold
right?
no for less than it was paid for. You know who it is?
No.
New York Yankees.
Oh, the
George Steinbrenner.
Right, gotcha.
Bought him for $8 million, and I think CBS had paid like $13 million for him.
I was in a I was thinking of the Dodgers with the whole McCourt problem.
No, they still made money on that. No. The Yankees actually were bought at a loss by George Steinbrenner, probably the greatest purchase in the history of a sports franchise.
Before we wrap up our final podcast of the 2018 season, we're going to try to do some hot stove ones later on this winter. There's some Mets news. Have you did you get a call to be the Mets GM? Because I got a call and I didn't even
no,
answer
I didn't,
it.
But
I just did a decline. I declined it.
Why? You don't want to be told what to do by Jeff Wilpon?
Everyone's declining this job. It's like the new thing now. It's just like turn down the Mets GM job. What a disaster this has turned into.
Yeah, really. Well, because the perception is that you're not really going to be the GM. You're going to be the number two guy behind Jeff Wilpon. And clearly that's the word that is out there. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you got some heavy hitters who have said no. Yeah,
Ben Cherington.
Yep.
You got Mike Chernoff, who is the son of the WFAN head honcho over there, which yep. I never thought would – I thought that would be kind of – not that he would turn down the job because his dad – with the WFAN, but I just thought that was a stretch because he's got a good thing going on with the Indians. You got Twins GM Thad Levine. He also turned it down.
Who does a terrific job.
Yeah, so a lot of these guys are turning it down. This is New York City. This is what was a big market, and I still think has a chance to be a big market, but everything is with the Wilpons. But listen to this.
How many of those people have spoken to Sandy Alderson, do you think?
Well, that's another thing is, like, at this point, if you're a Mets fan, would you take a healthy Sandy Alderson to be the GM of this team?
I don't think Sandy would go back, especially since Jeff has thrown him under the bus.
Hypothetically, would you, at this point, with all that's going on and some of the names you're hearing, you want some stability. Would you take an Omar Minaya at this point?
You know, Omar's a terrific judge of talent. How good a GM he is, I don't really know. I mean, would you take Steve Phillips back?
I don't know.
John Rico has been a very, very faithful soldier, you know, to Jeff Wilpon all these years. He's not even being considered for it. It's just not a good place to work right now. That's obvious.
Crazy.
I mean, why would you turn down the chance to take over a franchise in New York City?
And this is like a disaster, a nightmare for the Wilpons, because what they had when they had Sandy, you know, kind of like you have a GM in place and you don't have to open up your doors and you don't have to open up the scrutiny and the media coverage just to show how dysfunctional, how unwanted that you are as a franchise. No one wants to work for the team.
Well, you have
of that.
To remember something. You know, I don't even know if Sandy wanted to work for the team. He was basically right. installed there by Bud Selig as, you know, payback for bailing the Mets out of their little Madoff problem. So, you know, who knows if Sandy even wanted to be there or if the Wilpons wanted him there, and now they're blaming him for, you know, all their woes of the past 10 years, which, you know, is completely unfair. So, the word is out. It's a cancerous place to work. And right now it's probably more dysfunctional than the Knicks,
just
as possible.
Just to show you how dysfunctional it is, owner Fred Wilpon is said to be searching for a veteran baseball person as his GM, one who is familiar
Fred
with...
Fred Wilpon searching for his teeth.
He's searching for a veteran GM, one who is familiar with old-school scouting and comfortable around the game. His son is said to be looking for an analytical-based GM.
So they talk to each other?
They're looking for two of the different people.
Listen...
It's unbelievable.
I wasn't around the Mets as much this year as I have been in previous years, but I don't think Fred's in charge. I think Jeff is in charge. I think Fred is, you know, certainly he's a figurehead and he's, you know, he's the nice old guy on the pictures and all, but he's not the lead voice there.
Yeah, so now if that's the case, then they're going to be looking for a younger, like these 35-year-old Ivy League guys that come out of nowhere. If that's the case, like that's what's going to come down to.
Well, maybe they'll discover the next Theo Epstein.
Right, that's what's going to come down. You're not going to find...
And Jeff will ruin him.
You're not going to get a veteran GM that's going to come in and because he just doesn't want the job because he knows better. So you're going to have to find a guy who's, you know, younger, who wants that big break, who wants to become a GM, who might not be ready.
Well, all GMs, you know, they all claim they want autonomy, you know, and some of them claim they have it. None of them has it.
No young guy is going to get it.
Nobody has it. Brian Cashman doesn't have it. Everybody has a boss that they have to answer to.
Would you say that Cashman has the closest thing to full autonomy as any GM in baseball?
I think he's got a good situation. I think he's got a boss who trusts his judgment, you know, and that's different from having a boss who wants to meddle. And I think, you know, the reason why experienced GMs don't want to work for Jeff Wilpon is because they know they're not really going to be in charge.
This is bad. This is like a disaster for the Mets going right back into their face.
It's just another disaster. I mean, come on. Where do you rate the disasters with the Mets? I mean, you know, is it as bad as Mr. Met flipping the bird, or is it as bad as, you know, Yoenis Cespedes, you know, not playing for 6 weeks with a sore heel? Is it as bad as Matt Harvey not coming to work? Where does it fall?
This is at the top.
It's just another one.
It is. You're right. And this is important, man. This is like the architect of your team. And you brought up the Knicks thing. I think I would much rather have Dolan be my owner, because he's shown to spend money.
Having worked for Mr. Dolan, I might beg to differ, but I haven't worked for Jeff Wilpon.
Right. If you're looking at this from a fan, just from, you know, like how I watch the Knicks, is yes, I hate James Dolan because the Knicks have been awful for the last 20 years. But
there's other reasons.
You can't say
that
he's not spent money. Like, it just happens to be that no free agent wants to go to the Mets, and they don't have the money on top of it. But, you know, Dolan, from everything I've read, and you'll investigate this winter with the Daily News, is that Dolan stays out of the way. He lets Mills and their new coach. I don't even know the coaches. It changes every year.
David Fizdale.
Fizdale's the coach. He lets them do the thing. He stays out of the way, and he's not. You know, he'll sign a big free agent. You know, I almost rather have Dolan and the Knicks brain trust than what's going on with
the Mets.
How
about if Dolan buys the Mets? You think that would help?
I think it would. I think Met fans are so tired of the Wilpons and so frustrated and so willing to just say goodbye that they would take on James. That's an insane statement. I'm about to say.
The Wilpons aren't going anywhere. They bought the team dirt cheap. They undervalued it. They wound up stealing it from Nelson Doubleday, and it's probably quadrupled in value, so they ain't going anywhere.
They ain't going anywhere, but we are going somewhere. We're taking a hiatus.
Nice segue.
That was good, right? I finally learned something six months into this, this gig.
Yeah, it was a good season, brother.
It was a good season. I've never watched more Yankee games in my life. I usually watch every game. This year, you know, I invested interest doing this podcast with you. I had a blast. I mean, I learned a lot from you. We had some great guests. We had some great moments. And maybe over this offseason, I'll put together like a best of.
Best
clips, we'll put it out. We're still going to try to do some hot stove, some episodes later on once things get settled. Right now, there's no news. It's all speculation right now. But, you know, after the winter meetings, we'll come to you with maybe a monthly episode. And then hopefully we're back next year when we get some more news.
If baseball's back, we'll be back.
So. Right. And what do you got going on this offseason?
Well, I'll be writing a column for the Daily News, so I'll be a bunch of Knicks games, bunch of Jets and Giants games. I don't know if Giants games. God, that seems like
you're gonna have to write about Eli. It's big.
I know, man. I know.
Want your thoughts on.
I'm not a sentimental type, as you.
You're gonna be covering. I know that you're gonna be covering potentially Eli Manning, the end of his career.
Yeah,
the swan song.
Unless it ends, you know, this weekend, because I'm not working this weekend.
How do you think he gets traded? I think a trade could be in the works. I think they want to send him out. Other than on his ass, which he's been the last couple of weeks.
Well, if Ben McAdoo was still here, they'd send him out on his ass. How much longer is his contract?
I don't even know. I'm not.
Hopefully, they can sit down and talk about this and negotiate some kind of graceful exit strategy. I mean, the guy went 2 Super Bowls. I've never been a huge fan of his, quite honestly. You know, I think that he makes some really bad decisions back there. And when he doesn't have time, obviously. No time, any quarterback would look bad. Yeah. But he looks he gets almost panicky back there sometimes.
Well, now if he hears a stiff wind will knock him over. He's so panicky. Like, it's crazy.
But the other thing, on the other side of the coin, is he's got 2 terrific offensive weapons. He's got 2 terrific. He's got Beckham and he's got Barkley. And those are like 2 of the best at their positions in the league. So, you know, if you can't make an offense go with those 2 guys, maybe your time's up.
Yeah, you can make an argument that right now the Giants have their best running back in the history of their franchise and the best wide receiver, and they're still.
Well, let's not go crazy on Saquon Barkley in 6 games.
Could be.
All right, let's, you know.
Explosive.
I was very friendly with Tiki Barber. We did a radio show for years, and I'll say one thing about him. You may not like the way he left the Giants and all, but this son of a gun played 10 years.
He was so good.
Never missed a game.
That one year, he had like 2,000 rushing yards.
Thank you.
From scrimmage.
And awesome. a small guy who was durable, who rarely missed a play.
Yeah.
All right? For 10 years. So let's get back on Saquon Barkley in a couple of years.
This is the New York football podcast. We're going to keep it going.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk Giants and Jets next week.
Oh, brutal. That's what you have to look forward to as a baseball fan who that's your primary sport is watching baseball. I mean, this offseason is going to be kind of brutal. Knicks are not going to be good. Nets are going to be bad. The Jets are, like, as we do this, are 3-3. They're showing some hope, but they have a rebuilding team. They have a young quarterback.
Yeah, but on the bright side, the Yankees will be very active. There's right. no doubt about that.
And that's another thing. That's as we follow, as we wrap this up with the Yankees, is those years in 2008, 2009, 2010, when they had an old team and the season would end, you would almost feel like, oh, man, this is like another year that, Jeter's older, this team is older, they have bad contracts. That's not the case with this team. They have a young team. There is promise. You know, that's one way to look at it if you're a fan right now and you're looking at this offseason and what's ahead for the Yankees. There's promise ahead.
Yeah, no, the nucleus is young. They need pitching. You know, there's not a great free agent crop out there this winter. You know, there's guys like Cole Hamels. There's, I think Kershaw's got a team option, so you're not going to see him.
Corbin's the guy.
Corbin is the guy.
But he's
probably.
Not a one. He's not a one.
No.
He's a 2-3.
I think they'll probably re-sign Jay Happ, I think, if they can get a favorable deal. They're not giving him 5 years. There's no way.
How about definitely. Robertson?
I would let Robertson go.
Really?
Honestly, yeah, I would.
I would bring him back. I think he has a lot of value.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he gets into a lot of trouble. I think he was pretty lucky this year in a lot of situations. I just don't think he's the same pitcher. He's getting older, and how many years is he going to want?
He's 33. I would give him 2 years at $9 million a year.
If he'll take that, fine.
I would do that in a second.
He may find somebody else who wants to use him as a closer and give him more money.
That's true. But that's the thing with this team is that the bullpen, how bullpens change in baseball year to year. This bullpen's not going to look like it did at the end of the season. Britton's not going to be there. Chapman's a year
Actually,
older.
Actually, Britton, I think, has a chance to come back.
You think Britton more than?
I think he has a chance.
More than Robertson?
Well, I didn't say more than Robertson, but I think you asked me, would I bring Robertson back?
Right.
I don't know what Brian Cashman's going to do. I wouldn't bring him back.
I can see Britton getting, like, insane money. I can see him getting, like, $60 million.
Yeah, but it's possible that they'll plunge on Britton.
Okay. So there's a lot of question marks. It's been a great year. We've enjoyed talking to you every week. We're going to do more episodes later on with some hot stove stuff. But just thank you to the listeners out there. You guys are the reason we do this show. It's been a great run. Unfortunately, the New York Yankees didn't get to that finish line where you didn't get to do our podcast from Battery Park for the parade. So maybe next year the Yankees will try to chase down that elusive, was it 28th title? 28th title. And the Mets, too. The Mets got to get their
trying to get number three.
Number three, the Mets. It's been a great season. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back. Don't worry. We'll be back.
We'll see you.